Hello and thanks for downloading IASB Update. I'm joined here today by Ian McIntosh, the Vice Chairman of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, a Senior Technical Director of the IASB. Today we'll be providing a summary of the discussions held during the meeting of the IASB, which took place between 19th and 21st of March 2013. Just a very short housekeeping notice before we begin. Views expressed during this broadcast are solely those of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the board. So we'll start again today with agriculture. Ian?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. An exciting meeting as usual, but the first topic that we're going to discuss was quite easy. It was a due process question, and the board gave the staff permission to proceed with the due process and permission for balloting so that the agricultural standard and the subsequent changes to property, plant and equipment will proceed on schedule, although there was a tentative intention from two board members to dissent.
Yep, and I think looking at the timetable, we expect to have that out as an exposure draft. I think early in June is the plan at the moment.
So that's been one of our short-term projects, which if all this happens, has gone ahead quite successfully.
Okay. The comprehensive review of the IFRS for SMEs, Alan.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. We had, as people are aware, we had a review of IFRS for SMEs covering 2012 to 2014. So it's our first comprehensive review. I guess the most controversial issue here is that when the IFRS for SMEs were developed, they related to entities that did not have public accountability. And at the moment, SMEs are prohibited from, prohibits publicly accountable entities from stating compliance with IFRS for SMEs. And the question is whether or not we should relax that paragraph and whether it's too restrictive. So the issue is obviously you've got entities that are listed on stock exchanges and they perhaps are a lot smaller, perhaps more thinly traded, and it's whether they should be permitted to use IFRS for SMEs or still required because of their public accountability to stick with the full IFRSs. I think the board didn't reach a decision on this particular issue. A lot of this is about communication and clarity because you can get a lot of confusion out there if you're not quite sure what standard or people are complying with, or whether it's the SME or full IFRSs. So what the board's asked the staff to put together some examples of disclosure about how you might explain which set of standards you're applying before they'd be ready to take a decision on that.
Okay, sure. Well, excellent. Well, we'll await updates on that. So some very important discussions taking place surrounding our conceptual framework. Perhaps you'd both like to take us through.
We'll both go through that. And to put it in context, this is the second or third major meeting we've had on this. We had more than 10 hours in February on concepts. We had 10 odd hours in March, and we'll have another long session in April.
15 hours, I believe, is the planned timing. So, Ian.
And then we'll discuss it with ASAP, which we'll mention later, the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum. And the hope, the plan, is to get a discussion paper out early in July. So we're proceeding on plan. They are quite difficult and lengthy discussions. We're getting right down to the basics here. But they're very, very important. But please keep in mind that this is for a discussion paper, so these are not final decisions. This is decisions on what will be included in this discussion paper, what arguments should be presented, and there will be, we think, actually very few tentative decisions in the discussion paper. Let's see, but we want all the arguments out there, and we want really good responses. It'll be on exposure for 4 months, and we're really being encouraging people to get behind this and tell us what they think. So a couple of things that were discussed. One important one is OCI and profit and loss, a very controversial discussion. And the staff came up with three principles which were tentatively agreed to be put into the discussion paper. The first one is that items presented in the profit and loss communicate the primary picture of an entity's financial performance. So that gives profit and loss primacy. That's principle one. Principle two, all items of income and expense should be recognised in profit and loss unless presenting them in an OCI provides a better depiction of financial performance. So you look to see, they should be in profit and loss, that's the assumption, but if they can be better depicted in OCI, then they go there. Principle three, an item that has previously been presented in OCI should be reclassified, brackets, recycled, to profit and loss if the reclassification results in relevant information about financial performance in that period. So there's a recognition there that recycling is appropriate in quite a lot of circumstances.
Yep.
And just to finish off on that, we looked at two items that might fit into OCI. Bridging items, those are items when an asset or liability has two different measurement bases, one in the balance sheet and one in the profit and loss. And we take the fair value part of the balance sheet item into OCI. And the other one is mismatched remeasurements, which usually are over a period of time and smooth themselves out over a period of time. So there's great discussion on that. But, you know, we're not reaching decisions here. These are principles and proposals for the discussion paper. Alan, do you mind?
Yeah, I just say that the important thing is that the principle one, which is giving primacy to the profit or loss, I think is quite important. The other thing too that's difficult is that there's no silver bullet in this process, and that there's nothing that we've identified that says in all circumstances these items must be presented as part of an OCI. For example, they tend to be to have characteristics such as they tend to be items for which, as Ian said, you might measure it in the balance sheet using one measure, and in the income statement you actually want to show, for example, the interest received on it, and then the fair value change is the thing you pull out into OCI. So, but not that doesn't mean in every single case where you have a fair value measurement that you always want to put a component into OCI. So those are the basic ideas anyway. We've got three principles and then some classification categories.
We went on to constructive obligations and economic compulsion when we're looking at whether an item is a liability or not.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a very broad-ranging discussion, and it was tentatively agreed to put in the discussion paper additional guidance to help distinguish constructive obligations that result in a liability from economic compulsion that do not result in a liability. And the guidance, for instance, would state that to have a constructive obligation, you must have a duty or responsibility to another party, so not just to yourself, not just acting in your own best interests. The other party must be one who would benefit from the entity fulfilling its duty or responsibility, or suffer loss or harm if they didn't do it. And as a result of the entity's past actions, the other party can reasonably rely on the entity to carry out its duty. So they're explanatory guidance, really, on what constructive obligation means.
Yeah, we had another couple of other issues in there. We looked at the definition of income and expenses and essentially decided not to propose defining separate elements for gains, revenue, losses and expenses. We looked at the capital maintenance sections, and those familiar with our framework now know that it's a fairly sparse section of our framework, but we're not going to take that particular section on in this round of the framework. We'll leave that at the moment in terms of capital maintenance. And we discussed high inflation, and there'll be some work we've done, I think, on the hyperinflation project that might feed into this eventually. But at the moment, our changes to the framework will essentially carry forward the existing descriptions, I think, rather than guidance that's in there.
Sure. And when can we expect the discussion paper ballpark?
Yeah, early July.
Early July.
Yep.
Okay. First week, we hope. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Moving on to fair value measurement. Ian, that we discussed the unit of account for investments and subsidiaries, joint ventures and associates.
Yes. And there was again nice feisty debate on this one, and the board fairly split on some issues. But it was agreed that where there's not a quoted market price for the shares in those investments, so level two or level three measurement, then the unit of account is the investment as a whole. So that was agreed. 9 members agreed to that. And then there was lengthy discussion, what if there is, if there's a level one measurement, there is a price in the market. And 8 members tentatively agreed that it should then be price times quantity. So take the market price multiplied by the number of shares, and that's your value, despite the fact that it's a larger holding, or it's a controlling or an associate holding, etc. That'll be moving on. They'll move on to prepare an exposure draft for amendments to IFRS 13 on that basis.
Okay, great. Moving again swiftly on, annual improvements project, Alan, we looked at 2 of the 11 proposed improvements this time around.
Yeah, I think we're getting close to the end of the cycle, actually, in terms of the re-deliberation. First one I'll mention was related party disclosures, and this relates to the wording in our standard at the moment. It talks about key management personnel, and of course in some particular cases you can the key management personnel services are provided by an entity rather than an individual, and we thought it was important to make sure that in those circumstances where it's done through an entity, that's also called as a related party. So we're going to continue with some amendments that were proposed as part of that cycle. There was initially a plan to increase the amount of disclosure around those types of services, but the board decided that not to proceed at this stage with that. 11 board members supported not having those disclosures in there.
Okay, fantastic. And the other item we looked at, and that was the current and non-current liabilities.
Yes, this has been running for a little while. Came back, more discussion, and the decision was not to put this item into annual improvements in the end, but to ask the interpretation committee to reconsider what clarifications could be made to IAS 1 to address this issue. So they should come back to the board with suggestions for an amendment to IAS 1.
Okay, thanks very much. Narrow focused amendments. We looked at an amendment to IAS 1, presentation of financial statements.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. It's all about going concern and about disclosure. And we've had a protracted period of no economic growth in many places, and when companies actually end up going bust, essentially, there's a concern about disclosing the fact that there were these uncertainties leading up to into that period. And so we've been having a look at IS1 and the requirement to disclose the existence of uncertainties. Initially, this was taken to our interpretations committee, they had a look at it again in January, and they came up with some recommendations that we actually do propose some amendments to IS1 to try and improve the disclosures around going concern. The board's agreed in principle that we should do that, and what they've done is asked the staff to put together some specific proposals so they can actually see what those recommendations would look like. And this will come back again to an ISB meeting. It's been passed back up from the Interpretations Committee to us, and we'll take this through the next step as well.
Sure. Okay. Thanks very much. Moving on to one of our more established projects, the revenue recognition.
It's established but nearly finished. Mm-hmm. We made a decision in February. We discussed application date, and it was decided 1st of January 2017. That's a very long lead time, much longer than normal, but this is an important standard. It will require some systems changes, and for those constituents that have to do 2 years comparatives, things start pretty quickly if you go sooner than 2017. And then on the back of that decision in February, we also decided that there would be no early application. Now, that was done a little bit quickly at that meeting, and people reconsidered it after the meeting, and we do have constituents who are looking towards this standard to help solve some outstanding problems they have with IFRS, and particularly in relation to IFRIC 15. And if we made them wait till 1st of January 2017 before they could address these issues through the new standard, of course they've got a problem for another 3 or 4 years. So we re-debated the item, and it was decided that we would allow early application. We had 11 votes for that, so it was reasonably strong. So that'll help some constituents. The people who opposed that were mainly worried about comparability, but the ISB has a long history of allowing early application, as against FASB, who won't allow early application of this standard, despite the ISB's decision to do so. So we'll have a few years of perhaps some not the best comparability that we could have.
Of course, the other thing is first-time adopters. So you can have a country that's coming on to IFRS, and if you prevent first-time adopters from adopting the standard, they have to change twice. So
sure.
It does make sense, I think, to help them out as well.
Last but not least, put options written on non-controlling interests.
Yeah, it's a fairly controversial issue. This is one that's been with the Interpretations Committee and the Board at various times. In fact, it's been around for quite a number of years now. The issue is whether or not you get these changes in the carrying amount of a put option on a non-controlling interest, essentially whether it should go through income or through equity. That's the core issue. And the Interpretations Committee has read this and concluded that it should go through income. I think that it's fair to say that the strong view is that this is the correct interpretation of the current wording, but there are others who think that this is wrong. And that it's misleading accounting.
Not a wrong interpretation.
Not a wrong interpretation.
A wrong treatment.
Wrong. Yeah. They say they don't like the outcome.
Yes.
So this has been, the Interpretations Committee has previously said, well, if you want us to interpret it, this is the answer, but we think you should consider it first. And because any interpretation comes out anyway has to be ratified by the Board. And I think the Interpretations Committee quite rightly sense that there was some concern about this, so didn't want to try and go ahead with an interpretation that perhaps ended up getting to the Board and ending up finding it was a problem. In fact, at the discussions, it became quite clear that there were more than four people at the Board table who would actually object to an interpretation if it was they developed it further, and so we just wouldn't get it out anyway. So what's happened is that the ISB has agreed to take this on as a separate project in essence. We'll now own this project and we'll bring it back over the next few months with a view to making some changes to IS32.
I mean, the counter argument to that was we're just up to our neck in concepts and we're considering all these issues conceptually, and the debate really was whether we should wait until we've decided conceptually what the answer is or whether we should do some fixing in the meantime.
Yeah, and it's always the dilemma the Board faces because, as Ian just mentioned, in revenue recognition, there are some issues with IFRIC 15 that some people are concerned with. The Interpretations Committee said that they didn't want to act because we had an active project that's taken longer than anticipated, and there's a point of time which you need to help the existing people applying to the standard. And the case of concepts will be 2015 before we plan to finish, and so we can actually make some shorter term improvements in the, rather than waiting to the conceptual answer.
Okay.
And then hope that the conceptual answer comes out the same way.
Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, well, thanks very much. That just about covers the projects discussed at the meeting. This is a sort of closing note. It's shaping up to be quite a busy April, isn't it?
Yes, it's in fact, this is the week after the Board meeting now. We're recording this and it's a fairly quiet week, but it's going to get very busy because on the 8th of April we have the very first Accounting Standards Advisory Forum meeting, ASAF as we call it. We have 12 standard setters or standing setting bodies have been appointed to this advisory forum. They're going to be meeting here in London on the 8th of April. It's a public meeting.
8th and 9th.
And the 9th, 2 days. So, and the main topic of discussion is conceptual framework, but they're also going to be discussing the impairment proposals that we have, there'll be a presentation of the FASB's impairment proposals so that we can see them side by side and get feedback from the standard setters. Also on the 9th, so it's a bit of overlap, our trustees are meeting here in London for 3 days as well. So we have a very full schedule coming up in the second week of April.
Okay. Of course, details of both meetings are available on the meetings diary on our website for those interested in finding out more. And I think that just about draws our discussion to a conclusion. A written ISB update is available for download via the IFRS website for those interested. But aside from that, that's about it. And thanks very much for joining us. And we'll see you, you'll listen to us again next month. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.